Have you been briefed by the CDC? Are the words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and we have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
Totally under control. Those were the words President Trump used in late January to assure Americans the government was ready for the coronavirus. He said them in an interview with CNBC on the day Seattle recorded the first U.S. case of COVID-19. We know now the response to COVID was not totally under control, quite the opposite. So far, 220,000 Americans have died. More than 8 million have been infected. Oscar-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney tried to figure out why the United States, the wealthiest, most developed nation and home to some of the world's leading infectious disease experts, failed so stunningly to the shock of almost everyone worldwide. It's the question at the center of his new documentary, Totally Under Control.
What went wrong for us?
The truth is that political leaders caused avoidable death and destruction.
The scientists sounded the alarm every day. The U.S. government was doing nothing.
And Alex Gibney joins me now. Welcome back.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, welcome back so soon, because this is the second documentary that we've been talking about from you in about a month. So the previous one was Agents of Chaos, about Russian disinformation during the 2016 campaign. And I guess I'm wondering, with the pair of these movies, because you can read them as a pair, as a very strong critique of the Trump administration, are you trying to send voters a message?
Well, I think the films, if you watch both films, you would draw the conclusion that I'm going to stand behind that. Yes, I am trying to send a message, which is that in both cases, the Trump administration failed miserably and honestly betrayed the country.
And we are seeing that play out in real time now with the response, or the lack thereof, to coronavirus. And yeah, you do have a reason for getting these out before the election. But are the people who are going to watch this movie and Agents of Chaos, are they predisposed to your point of view? Would they, you know, are you preaching to the choir?
I don't know. I mean, I make these films for everybody. And I hope that everybody will come. I can't dragoon people to watch them. But I do think that if people come to them fairly and honestly, they will be alarmed by the Trump response to the pandemic, whether they're opponents of Trump or whether they're supporters. I think it's that clear and evident. But you also hope that other people who are less engaged in the political process see something like this and realize the existential moment we're in and how important it is to vote. So there's all sorts of people I hope will come to this film. And, you know, we made it as a film about competence, not as a film that was meant to serve the interests of any political party.
That day that the first person was diagnosed with it in January was the exact same day someone was diagnosed with it in South Korea. And you use that as a reason to compare and contrast the two countries. We know now that South Korea's response was the better response. But could the United States have done what South Korea did? Because South Korea also was looking at its own experience with MERS 5 years previously and had already put in place systems to correct the response.
Well, the great irony is that the United States had its own playbook. I mean, there was a rigorously developed playbook based on experience of previous epidemics put together by the Obama administration, which, you know, it had been passed on to the Trump administration. But then, even more intriguingly, the Trump administration had conducted a kind of vigorous pandemic exercise with its key pandemic officials, the people who look out for this kind of thing, in 2019 and put together a report in October 2019, just before the pandemic hits here, that amounted to, you know, a very complete playbook of what to do right and what mistakes to avoid. They had it all there, but they never took it off the shelf. They didn't implement any of the playbook that they had so rigorously compiled.
Why didn't they do that?
I think the simple answer is it was a combination of incompetence and also political opportunism, that the Trump administration didn't want to believe in COVID as a pandemic, because if there was a pandemic, that meant people were going to get it. If you tested for it, it was going to reveal more and more cases, and that was going to upend the Trump administration's claim that all was well, because after all, he was, you know, cruising, he thought, on the waves of a powerful economy to re-election.
Right. And the other thesis of your film, or the co-thesis of your film, is that he and his administration would choose politics over science and lead the response based on politics, not science. And I want to play a clip from your movie of a woman named Nancy Messonnier. She's a high-ranking official in the CDC, and she holds this telephone news conference where she warns that COVID could really disrupt our lives. And this is back in February.
We expect we will see community spread in this country. It's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more of a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness. For schools, options include dividing students into smaller groups, or in a severe pandemic, closing schools and using internet-based teleschooling to continue education.
So she really previewed what would come to pass many months later, but at the time, no one was really saying these things. And the president was on a state visit to India at the time. What was the reaction to what she said?
He was furious. I mean, the global reaction, or the economic reaction, was the markets plummeted. And that was Trump's crown jewel. He was protecting particularly the Dow. And suddenly, you know, stock prices were nosediving as a result of this ominous news, because the Trump administration had really vigorously been trying to convey a different message, which is that it's totally under control, or as, you know, Alex Azar, you know, was putting it, we've got this. It's not a problem. Don't worry.
And what happened to her, her career? Was she punished at all?
She's still at the CDC, but we don't hear from her very often anymore. And that's because over time, you know, the Trump administration has tried very hard, with great success, unfortunately, to steer the message of the CDC in a way that comports with the political messaging that the Trump White House wants to deliver.
One of the most damning parts of your movie comes toward the end, where you get to the supply chain issues with the PPE and how that was bungled from the White House. And you talk to a young man named Max Kennedy, who was a volunteer on a task force that Jared Kushner convened to gather up all this PPE. He became a whistleblower. He was forced to sign an NDA, even as a volunteer. But anyway, he broke that NDA, apparently. He became a whistleblower. And I just want to play another piece of tape from your movie where he talks about what it was like to work on that task force.
I think when people imagined the federal government response in the war room, they thought it would be this big, you know, energized group of experts, not 10, 20-year-old volunteers, all just with private laptops, no industry relationships, no experience working in supply chain. So we started cold emailing people we knew who had business relationships in China, looking for factories online, and emailing them from our personal Gmail accounts. Because we had never done this before, you know, there were all these really basic questions about how a federal procurement operation should work.
And then he goes on to say that his team eventually didn't even purchase a single mask. What was that task force doing? What was its purpose?
Well, allegedly, and this was announced to some fanfare, Jared Kushner big businessman was going to step in and save the government from incompetence and show how it was done. And he was going to, you know, secure vital supplies of PPE, particularly N95 masks, for healthcare providers, notably doctors and nurses in hospitals who were treating COVID patients and whose lives were at risk. So it was a pretty important job and a pretty important moment. Then to discover that the task force doesn't have any federal procurement associated with it. It's composed of 10 volunteers with absolutely no industry relationships. And furthermore, to the extent that PPE was obtained, and sometimes it was, young Max Kennedy, who's the grandson of Robert F. Kennedy, would sometimes cut a deal. He wouldn't be allowed to pay for it through government procurement, but he would then pass that on to five chosen companies by the Trump administration. These companies would then have that material imported at taxpayer expense and then were free to sell that material for whatever price they wanted. And at least 50% of that material could be sold in states that weren't even experiencing hot spots if, you know, the price was right. It could even be sold to foreign countries. So that's for a country that's in the middle of a pandemic, the idea that they're recklessly allowing companies to profiteer on PPE when doctors and nurses are at risk of dying, it's just a staggering story. I mean, it's something out of Joseph Heller. You'd almost think it was made up. It was so fantastical.
Yeah. And so was there any fallout from that? I mean, you didn't hear much about what happened with this disastrous task force, where the states just had to go and get this PPE all on their own. There wasn't any kind of investigation into perhaps, you know, malfeasance that occurred on the federal level or anything like that?
There is an ongoing investigation, as I understand it, in the Senate and I believe possibly in the House. But I think it was initially lost in the noise of a very clever about face by the Trump administration, which was to blame the states for the problem that the federal government had created.
Well, even Trump, who wanted to keep the news, as we discussed at the beginning, keep the news of this pandemic, you know, on the low flame, in order not to spook people and not to spook the economy, that he really wanted the economy to remain strong. Obviously, that tactic didn't work, and the economy has now cratered. So why didn't anyone in the administration take a look at what was happening come March, April, and on and say, okay, we really need to change course here, attack this thing head on, if only to save the economy, because that was what he was going to win his reelection based on?
I mean, I think this administration is possessed of magical thinking. And, you know, having lost the opportunity to contain the virus, and we did have an opportunity to contain it. We could be like South Korea now if we had moved quickly. And South Korea never had to shut down its economy. People move freely. They're not as encumbered as we are today. But the Trump administration was always behind, and yet it kept hoping that everything was going to go away. Remember, it's going to go away by Easter. We'll all be back in church. When the sun comes out and the heat comes out, it's going to disappear. Well, if you don't attack a problem, you know, if you have a hole in the roof and you keep insisting that it's never going to rain and it keeps raining, you know, the problem isn't in the roof. It's the owner of the house.
And yet you look at Europe and they did attack it and they did have a broad shutdown and they did implement, at least in Germany, aggressive contact tracing. And look what's happening today in Europe. It's a disaster.
Europe is having problems, and it's not that this is easy, but I think in terms of reckoning with a scale of how well or how badly was the response handled, you know, if you look at the United States, which has, I believe it's 4% of the world's population and 20% of the world's deaths, we are clearly on the wrong side.
Well, it's always great speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline. Always a pleasure.
filmmaker Alex Gibney. His latest documentary is called Totally Under Control, about the U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic, and you can stream it now on Hulu. Well, just 6 days to go. 6 days to go before we end our fundraiser, our Power in Numbers drive. So really, time is running out for you to become a member or renew your membership or add a little bit extra if you've already renewed this year. We really do count on you, as we've just been talking about with Alex. This has been just an extraordinary year. We don't have to tell you that. And it has affected us here at KCRW, of course, financially. And so we just need a little extra from you if you can do it. If you're not hurting, many of us are, of course, but if you're not hurting and can give a little bit to us, we would certainly appreciate it. KCRW.com/join. And if you do it now, your dollar will be matched dollar for dollar by KCRW board member Paul and Renee Haas. They have a very generous challenge grant in the making, and they are going to match your dollar, so your money goes twice as far. Now's the time to do it. KCRW.com/join. Coming up, how UV light can disinfect the air. It's cheap, it's easy to install, so why aren't more schools using it? We'll find out next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Branwell. From Lysol wipes and hand sanitizer to air purifiers and bleach, people are using whatever they can get their hands on to try to kill the coronavirus. One more tool getting some attention these days is ultraviolet light, or more specifically, a type of UV light called UVC. It has extra short wavelengths and enough energy to stop viral cells from reproducing. But this type of light can be dangerous if not used properly. We're going to talk about this now with Dr. Edward Nardell. He teaches medicine at Harvard Medical School and specializes in UV air disinfection. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, how does this light work, this UVC light? Is it the same kind of light we would get in a bright sunny day if we went outside?
No, actually, there is no UVC in sunlight. It's all filtered out by the atmosphere. So any UVC that we want to use for air or surface disinfection has to be produced by a lamp, a specialized lamp. And because the viruses or bacteria in the air or surfaces are unprotected by an outer dead layer of skin, they're easily penetrated by UVC. And the UV essentially causes mutations of their nucleic acids, either DNA or RNA, making it impossible for them to replicate.
And how would you apply it practically? Would you have to be holding the light and wave it over surfaces where the virus might be?
Well, that's probably there are many ways to apply it. Let me start by saying, and the one you mentioned, the UV wand to wave over things, is probably the least effective and perhaps most dangerous, although it's not terribly dangerous. I don't recommend that at all. The most useful way of using UV is actually in the upper room above people's heads to disinfect the air in the room. And then a certain amount of turnover happens between the lower and upper room air, especially if you have a low-velocity ceiling fan, and this disinfects the air throughout the room. That's the most effective way to disinfect air in a room. And in hospitals, it's used directly in unoccupied rooms by what are called UV robots that move within the room to try and get at all the surfaces behind shadows and nooks and crannies. That's a very specialized use of UV for decontaminating surfaces between occupants.
Are these UV light panels, UVC light panels, are they installed in most hospitals in the upper part of the rooms?
No, they're not. they were more widely used, actually, believe it or not, in the 1940s and 50s when we were just we didn't really have treatment for tuberculosis and we didn't have vaccines for viral respiratory infections. And then we did get antibiotics and we did get vaccines and TB went down. And it wasn't until the mid-80s and early 90s that we had a bit of a resurgence of TB in this country and these fixtures became more widely used in hospitals, but not universally. And part of it is engineers aren't taught about this technology. It hasn't had a big role in recent years. And so you have to really seek out expertise. I think in a few years, you won't have to seek it out because COVID is really bringing this technology into wide use.
So I can see that it would be really useful, not only in hospitals, but in any place where there are large gatherings of people, like classrooms, for example.
Absolutely. And we have a school in Cambridge, right near where I live in Boston, that is putting upper room germicidal UV throughout its classrooms. Also being done in homeless shelters. That's where I first started using it decades ago. In a tennis club, very old tennis club in the Cambridge area, it has upper room germicidal UV to make it safe to play tennis. It can be used in a wide variety of settings and is, as I say, the most cost-effective way.
How expensive is it? How much would it cost to, let's say, put a panel in a classroom?
So again, these are fixtures that you hang on the wall, permanently install. I mean, it looks like a fluorescent lamp, but it's putting out UV. And it costs about $1,000 roughly. If you bought a lot of them, they'd probably be considerably cheaper. And they have to be installed in a certain way above people's heads. The system has to be checked for safety. And so usually the manufacturers or there are specialized consultants around who can help you decide how many you need, where to place them, and go back before you turn it on and make sure that it's safe.
And you'd have to also have some kind of air purifier as well, or would that be it for a classroom?
That would be it. It is an air purifier. It works in a different way than a filter does. And I want to make an important point, and that is there's a lot of attention right now. Some people, in response to the concern about airborne COVID, are saying, oh, we'll put filters in the system. And there's nothing wrong with putting filters in the system. But I think it's critically important to deal with transmission in the room where it's happening and not after the air leaves the room. So if I'm in a room with you and I'm infectious, it's not very comforting to know that when the air leaves and goes into the ventilation system, it's going to be filtered. So that's where UV comes in. And these are all good technologies that need to be applied.
There are a lot of UV wands for sale on Amazon. Do you think people should ignore those?
Yeah, I really do. You know, a UV wand is usually a very weak UV lamp. And thank goodness, because you're waving this thing around. And the dangers of UVC are that it can cause low level but painful irritation of the eyes. And it can cause low level irritation of the skin. So these are gimmicks, I think. And again, most people in a home are exposed to people who they think are safe. So who are you protecting in a home? I don't think it's going to make a big Thanksgiving dinner safe for everybody there either. So, you know, I think it is really for public places.
Dr. Edward Nordell, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Well, you'd usually find a different kind of wand being waved at Disneyland, but the happiest place on earth and other Southern California theme parks remain closed. Yesterday, the state issued new protocols for them to reopen. Initially, that brought a glimmer of hope, but meeting the requirements may take a lot more time, many more months, leaving the theme park industry and its employees stuck on a ride that just won't end. Hugo Martin is a business writer who covers the travel industry for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the protocols for reopening divide parks into large and small. What are the new protocols and how are they distinguished?
Okay, so So the way the state has put out the protocols, a theme park with a capacity of 15,000 guests or more is a large theme park, and one 15,000 guests and less is a small theme park. So most of the major theme parks that we all know, Disneyland, Universal Studios, Six Flags, they'll all qualify as large theme parks. I think maybe among the small ones would be like the amusement park at the Santa Monica Pier. That might fall under a small one. And under the protocols, the small ones can open when a county where the theme park is located is in the third tier or the orange tier of the state's, you know, reopening protocol. The large theme parks have to wait until the county they're in reaches the fourth tier or yellow. So for places like Universal Studios, which is in L.A. County and that's still in the purple, the first tier, it could be quite a while before they get the go-ahead to open. Orange County, where Disneyland's located, they're in the red or second tier. They still have quite a ways to go. I think their Orange County's public health official estimated that maybe summer of 2021 before reach that. Yeah. So
they've already laid off lots and lots of workers. Disney has at Disneyland, and they must be apoplectic that they won't be allowed to reopen until next summer.
Yeah, there was just a press conference not too long ago, a couple of minutes ago, actually, of presidents of all the local theme parks, and their big concern was, one, their employees being out of work now 7 months, and also the companies that, the shops and businesses that rely on theme park business, you know, the restaurants and the hotels near Disneyland, near Universal Studios, they're, you know, in the same position. They're laying off people and they're having to pay, mortgages and utilities and all these other bills without any income coming in. So it's having a ripple effect throughout.
Well, what are they saying to the argument that, well, these places could be easily COVID hotspots with so many people gathering in one place? What is their response to that?
Their response is that they've been able to open theme parks in other parts of the country and other parts of the world without, evidence of being a COVID hotspot. I mean, Disney World in Orlando has been open since July. Universal, also in Florida, has been open about the same time. Theme parks in Europe and Asia have been open for a while. And they've been, imposing a lot of restrictions, capacity limits. All the guests have to wear masks, temperature taken at the entrance, that sort of thing. And their argument is we can open these parks just as we've opened other parks, and it can be safe. It's been proven.
Well, didn't California send officials to Florida to see how it was going there? And I guess they weren't convinced?
Yeah, the state did send people to Florida. They also sent people to the parks here in Southern California to see, what sort of protocols they had suggested, how they think they could reduce the risk. Apparently that didn't really sway the state much, because they came back pretty much with the same protocols that they were considering about 2 weeks ago, before they did these investigations.
Is it possible that Disney and others will pursue some kind of legal action against the state?
They were asked that today with the presidents of the theme parks, and they didn't discount that idea. It's unclear whether you can sue a state over a health crisis, health crisis protocols. I'm sure if that were possible, then all the restaurants that have been closed and other businesses would have done it by now.
So, well, the churches I'm not sure did, they lost in court.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like that's a viable option, but again, the theme parks didn't discount doing that. They mostly said they're going to try to work with the administration and persuade them, and they urged, theme park fans and others to write and call to their, state lawmakers to try to get something changed in that sense.
But economically, summer was the high season for these parks. So hasn't the damage been done? I know there's increasing damage, but it's to a lesser extent now, perhaps?
Well, yeah, although, Halloween has also become one of their busiest times of the year. Universal does, a big Halloween celebration that goes on for many nights, Knott's Berry Farm and Six Flags as well. And the Christmas holidays are also, the Christmas time is also one of their busiest times for theme parks, especially Disneyland. I mean, typically around Christmas and New Year's, Disneyland is so full, they reach capacity, they have to close their gates. So, summer was one of their busiest times, but they're also coming up on a couple of other busy seasons that they're going to stay shuttered for.
You've talked to some employees, I understand, of these parks. What are they telling you?
They're real anxious. They don't know what to do. They've been without work for 7 months. They would love to go back to work at their theme parks. They say they love their jobs there. And they're sort of holding out hope that they can return someday. Only a couple of the, theme park workers I've talked to have moved on to other jobs. Most of them are just, collecting unemployment and hoping that something will happen for them to return. They feel like, it's part of a family when they work there, and they can't let it go, really.
Hugo Martin, business writer who covers the travel industry for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We're in the final stretch. We want you in. We want to count you in our family and be part of the KCRW community. KCRW.com/join. Just 6 more days to go of this Power in Numbers drive. So if you haven't done it, now is the time to do it. And you have an added incentive because your dollar will go twice as far. We have a very, very generous challenge grant. So if we can raise $25,000 by midnight tomorrow, we will be able to double our donations. We'll get $25,000 from our very generous board member, Paul Haas, and his wife. And so now is the time to do that. KCRW.com/join. Tons of great thank you gifts there. We have lots of KCRW swag that you can sport proudly on your next Zoom call. Speaking of Zoom, I'm hosting a trivia night tonight at 7 o'clock, and members get in for free. So become a member and play some trivia. Have a fun night. Night out on the town from inside your house. KCRW.com/join. I hope to see you there. Coming up, next weekend was supposed to be the Super Bowl for costume shops.
You live for Fridays and Saturdays to be Halloween. And this year, I think I've done 2 rentals for friends. So yay.
How the pandemic is ruining a lucrative holiday. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, Halloween is just 10 days away, but it's not feeling as festive this year. LA County has discouraged trick-or-treating. Large gatherings, like massive parties, aren't allowed. So for shops that rent or sell costumes, it's not a good time. Halloween is usually their Super Bowl. Even worse, Halloween takes place on a Saturday this year. Sean LeBlanc joins me now. He owns the costume shop in North Hollywood. Hi.
Hello.
Well, normally, what would a Saturday night Halloween mean for you?
You live for Fridays and Saturdays to be Halloween because it gives you a lot more parties. You're going to see a lot of parties on Saturday, on Friday, possibly some on Sunday. And because that's the big weekend, you'll see parties the weekend before and even parties the weekend after. And this year, not much of anything.
Are you still open?
We are. As I also do industry rentals. So we do film, theater, TV, schools, other things.
So you are renting for productions like TV shows, commercials, movies?
Yep.
But Halloween is just nothing's happening, really.
I think I've done two rentals.
Two?
For friends.
Oh, wow.
So yay.
Yay. Wow. So I imagine this time last year, you were just licking your chops thinking about what Halloween would be like this year.
Yeah, we had a Friday Halloween, which was fantastic. And then this was just Saturday. And normally we're open extended hours. We're open 7 days a week. We have extra staff on. It's super busy. And this year, it's like we just sort of have nothing happening.
Monetarily, what does that look like?
Monetarily, that's a big hit because October is a time that if you're behind on stuff, you can actually catch up in October. I remember when I worked at Somewhere in Time years ago in Pasadena, they would make enough in October to carry them all the way through April or May of the next year.
Are you worried that you won't be able to stay afloat at all?
Well, luckily, I do film and TV in schools and then theater. Theater is the big thing I do a lot of. I design a lot of theater in LA and around. And it's really hard on that sense because that's such a big portion of our business. But I think with the film and TV stuff, that will help. And I think with the schools, like I said, being very creative, we have a couple schools that are doing Zoom versions of shows. We have one school that's actually filming three Horton Foot one acts. So everyone's being very creative. It's a creative time for arts in school, you know, and I'm very tenacious. And it's like, I'm sorry, it's my business. It's my life. It's what I do. I'm not intending to go anywhere.
Well, how do you do that with the schools? Do you send costumes to individual homes?
We do a couple different things because we are following the COVID guidelines as per the white pages for the industry. So we are disinfecting. We're doing all that kind of thing. We're wearing our masks, washing our hands. And so we can actually do fittings, and I have a nice fitting room that's air conditioned and things like that, so the air keeps flowing, and we only do one at a time. And we've also done things where we pulled costumes and just sent them to schools or to theaters.
Are people, do you know, and don't name any names, but are people throwing covert Halloween parties and coming to you for costumes?
You know, I haven't really seen anybody doing that. You know, normally we have party planners that are coming in saying, hey, we've got people coming to this event. The West Hollywood parade down on Santa Monica Boulevard, that is not happening this year. And this is really a time when you would actually see these huge, huge costume events and costume parties. And they're just not happening.
Are you thinking that you may have to retool your entire business going forward, even after, you know, we get a vaccine and all that? Do you think that your business will have to change fundamentally?
Yes. I'm part of the 892 Designers Guild, and I'm working on getting my 705 card back so I can actually just go as a costumer on the set and day check or, you know, dress background or polish shoes. We're also thinking about starting a retro vintage line of clothing with a friend of mine in Beverly Hills and tailoring things to people who kind of live that style, because there's a ton of people across the country who do the retro vintage living.
What is that? What is retro vintage living?
It's the people that go to like Cicada Club and they actually dress in the period and they have cars and houses in the period. And it really goes from mostly 20s into the 50s and the 60s. But there's the gentleman from England who does all his Victorian clothing and wears them on the street. So I think you're seeing an interesting resurgence of people saying, hey, look, I want to be elegant and do something.
So these are for people who want to dress like this daily, like out on the streets, not just for a party.
Exactly.
So I can see how people would be interested now in dressing in period costume.
Yeah.
Wanting to escape into another era. I can see the appeal of that.
Yes. And remember, you have all the reenactors that do the Victorian ball, the Regency dancers, Renaissance fair, the medieval reenactors. You know, so you've got a lot of really cool outlet for those things.
And you're going to try to take advantage of that and retool your business to cater to that need.
Yeah. And even, you know, as a customer, I'm out there trying to find things. And so much of what is, especially the original stuff, is just too delicate to wear. 20s clothing, interestingly enough, doesn't hold up as much as Victorian clothing does, because the 20s stuff tended to be like silks and crepes and things like that. So you can have, you know, clothing that's 200 years old, that's in perfect condition, and something from the 20s that's, you know, you look at it and sneeze and it just disintegrates.
Well, sneeze. Yeah. If you could wear any costume right now, what would it be?
Oh, I mean, the things I've been doing lately, just because I've been working so much for Halloween, it's just, I put my kilt on and call it a day.
Fair enough. Sean LeBlanc, he is owner of the Costume Shop in North Hollywood. Thank you, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
All right. Halloween or not, the tradition here in the fall is to have a fall fundraiser here on KCRW, and that's what we're doing. We're having a regular fall fundraiser in a very irregular year. So it still means that we need your support. KCRW.com/join. That's the place to go. And you can be entered to win our Catalina Island sweepstakes. That is such a fantastic sweepstakes. Prize includes dining there, hotel activities, ferry transit for four. Sounds like a great getaway. So get in on that action. KCRW.com/give or 800-600-KCRW, 800-600-5279. Steve Chertakis is here to preview Greater LA. Hi there.
Hello. I'll be in my Cookie Monster onesie, Madeline.
Oh, yeah. That is your go-to. Which, every year I would see you in your go-to. Cookie Monster.
So easy.
Oh.
I love it. We're going to talk about actually coming up. You guys talked about Vroman's bookstore, right, in Pasadena.
Yeah.
It's found some trouble, obviously, in the coronavirus era. We're going to talk about the last bookstore in downtown LA and how they're doing and whether or not they're going to be able to survive through all of this. So bookstores galore.
Yeah, wow. It is really tough out there for independent booksellers.
Whew. It sure
so
is.
So if you need to buy a book, buy one from them for sure. Support the local economy. It also goes with supporting KCRW.
And read, for goodness sakes. Read.
Yeah, do that too. It's all part of the same ecosystem. Thank you, Steve. Coming up, why there are more white sharks in our waters these days and why you should not be very afraid. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 2020 is at it again. There are more sharks off the Southern California coast than ever before. That's according to the Cal State Long Beach Shark Lab. This year, they tagged three times as many sharks as last year, even with fewer marine biologists in the field because of COVID. Chris Lowe is director of the Shark Lab, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, it's going really well, and I guess it's going really, really well for the sharks. More than ever, huh? Is that a good thing? I mean, it's a good thing, I guess, for you, but I think swimmers might be a little leery.
Well, it's a good thing for everybody. It's a good thing for us. It's a good thing for the sharks. And it's not like there are three times more sharks suddenly. It's just that we're seeing more along our coast. And that's something we're trying to figure out. Why is that?
And what do you think?
Well, so we've been tagging and tracking juvenile white sharks in Southern California for 12 years now, trying to get a handle on the patterns. And some years we see lots of sharks and some years we see fewer. The most that we've typically tagged in a summer are like maybe 12 or 18 sharks. But this year we've tagged 38 so far and the season isn't over.
Wow.
So it could be, you know, a harbinger of climate change. You know, our waters are getting warmer and staying warmer longer. You know, our winters are getting milder, and we've learned that these young white sharks don't really like cold water. So normally when our water gets cold, that's the cue for them to migrate south to Baja, and that's where they overwinter.
Why don't they like the cold water?
Well, that's something we don't understand. White sharks are endotherms, which means as long as they're swimming, they can generate heat and keep that heat and keep their body warmer than the water. But it may be that the babies are just a little too small to keep the heat and therefore act like a cold-bodied shark. So what's really interesting is that for the first time, we're actually seeing white shark nurseries north of Point Conception. And we've documented those up now off Monterey and Santa Cruz for the first time.
Oh, and those waters are really cold, usually.
Normally. But the last few years, not so much.
Are you just looking at white sharks, or are there more of every kind of shark?
Well, our research has been focusing primarily on white sharks. But, you know, as a shark scientist, it's exciting to see many other shark populations come back. So we've been seeing more thresher sharks. We've been seeing more leopard sharks. And a lot of that has been due to better management. You know, we manage our fisheries better. So, you know, it's not just white sharks that are the beneficiaries of probably climate change, but also the fact that they've been protected.
Well, all of this is making surfers and swimmers feel a little nervous, right? I mean, if there are more sharks in the water, is there more of a chance that they might get bitten?
Well, that is a concern. And that was something we're interested in looking at. So we've actually been flying drone surveys all along the coast of Southern California from San Diego to Santa Barbara. And what we've noticed is that in certain locations, there are a lot of people in the water and there are a lot of sharks in and among those people. And those people don't see the sharks, but we can from the air. And what's really interesting is that the sharks just don't seem to care. They seem to just ignore people.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, we have hours and hours of footage of juvenile white sharks just swimming right by surfers and swimmers like they're not even there.
But I have heard that sometimes sharks will mistake a surfer for a seal because of the way that the surfer moves, or that maybe it's the black wetsuit, who knows, and take a nip.
Yeah, so accidents do occur, and we don't really understand why sharks occasionally bite people. What I can tell you is that more people are using the ocean than ever before, and that's particularly true for Southern California. And we have more sharks in our waters, but the rate of bites on people is not going up.
And what does this mean for the rest of the marine ecosystem to have more sharks in the water?
Well, that's a really important question that we'd like to answer too. And one of the things that's really interesting is that the number one species, marine species, that's involved in injuries to humans are stingrays. And we have lots of stingrays in Southern California. They're the favorite food of these juvenile white sharks. So it could be that the recovery of the white shark population is allowing them to bring that stingray population back down to where it should be. So, and that means that, believe it or not, having white sharks off your beach might keep you safer than if you didn't have them there at all.
Well, is there any downside that you can see of having a bumper crop of sharks?
No. And the reason why I say that is because we're not seeing any indication of these sharks being aggressive towards people or biting people. And I think that right there is a really good sign that so far they're using these habitats as nursery. So they're using it as very young individuals, probably for protection, for food, and for warmth. And it just so happens that we coincide at those beaches the same times they do. And so far, we don't seem to be impacting that behavior at all. Right now, I think it's good. It's a sign that conservation is working. We've been able to bring populations back, and we're learning how to share the environment with these animals.
You said that these are mainly adolescents or baby sharks in these waters. Where is the big mama shark? Is she swimming nearby?
So that's the big mystery. We don't know where they give birth. We don't think it's along the beaches because with all the planes and helicopters and people out there, somebody would see it, right? You know, a big 16-foot white shark giving birth to 15 5-foot babies. So we think maybe they're giving birth in the deeper water, in the channels, and then the babies swim to shore where it's warm and safe. We do see adult white sharks around the offshore islands, Catalina, the Channel Islands. That's typically where we see adults. And we see big females usually in the spring and early summer. And then the males start coming back from their ocean migration starting around this time of year and will hang around till about February. And then they'll go back offshore again.
Well, Chris, it's always great speaking with you. I always learn so much. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Chris Lowe, director of the Shark Lab at Cal State Long Beach. All right, it's come to the end of the show, and it's almost to the end of our fundraiser here on KCRW. If you haven't need to go online at kcrw.com/join and become a member or renew your membership, because time is running out and don't let it get away from you. So now is a perfect opportunity in between shows for you to make that donation. It just takes a few minutes and you'll feel so much better for having done it. And while you're there, you can check out all of our great thank you gifts that we have and also sign up for tonight's trivia night that I'm hosting. So that'll be really fun. You're probably a news junkie if you're listening to this show and to other NPR shows, so maybe you'll ace it and maybe you'll win the big prize. I think the big prize is more KCRW swag and also bragging rights, of course, which is invaluable. KCRW.com/join. Any amount gets you in as a member. And if you have contributed, thank you so much. And if you'd like to up your contribution, we would certainly love that. Many people are doing that during these COVID times, realizing that we need your support now more than ever. KCRW.com/join. Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.